All week we've been hearing about the historic protests going on in Cuba. I was talking earlier in the week with author and Latin American consultant Stephen Murphy, who has extensive contacts all over Latin America. And he connected me with an associate of his on the island, whose name is Jorge. We are not going to use his last name. And I called him up and spoke with him last night, and he started our conversation by apologizing.
I just will ask you, please, to go slowly with your English, because my English is not in a good shape. I haven't spoken more than 2 years.
Well, he made himself more than clear, laying out the conditions that he and his fellow Cubans are currently living under.
So today in Havana and yesterday, the city is like in silence. Nobody speaks. There are a lot of police officers walking around on the street, and there are a lot of people like dressing civil clothes, but people that obviously we know that work for the police forces as well. And it's very strange what is going on, because everybody knows that behind that picture of peace and quiet, the real thing that is going on is that people are very afraid. There are a lot of people who are in jail right now. I have friends in jail. We still have people in Cuba who support the government, and the government make a call to combat everyone who was protesting. So now you have like this fight between families and friends, because you have some people in the families or some people in your friends who support the system. You know, a lot of division, a lot of people afraid, a lot of pain, I would say. You know, we have hope. We are happy because for the first time in 60 years, people went out and people very clearly, people asked for freedom and human rights and change.
Are people protesting the entire communist system, or are they protesting over shortages of food and medicine?
I was in the protest. I was on the street. People were asking for freedom. That was the most common word that we were repeating all the time. We were asking for freedom. We want freedom. We want to be free. We want to express ourselves. We want to say what we think. We want to choose what to do with our life. I think that is the real thing that people are asking for, even when, of course, a shortage of medicines and food are huge problems, and not only the shortage of food and medicines, also the healthcare system is collapsed, at least in the east of Havana. So there are people that are dying on the street because of COVID. There are hospitals who are packed full with not enough beds, not enough ventilators. So because of all those things, of course, people are tired. People want to see this government opening things, doing some important change, and not only cosmetic change like they have been doing in the last years. We want to see a structural change in the economic system, in the political system as well. We want to see that we have the opportunity to create businesses and to grow and to make money. And we want to have a free election, and we want to have different political parties and not only one point of view. And we want to have the right to choose which education we want for our kids. So all those things together in a context when there is a huge shortage of food and medicines, that is the reason why people this Sunday, they went outside to ask for freedom and for change.
Is there something that you think the United States should be doing to help?
Yeah, so of course I'm against the embargo, and I think that is something that has to change. But in this moment right now, we are not asking the U.S. government to stop the embargo. We are asking the Cuban government to stop the embargo they have on the Cuban people. We are asking the Cuban government to open up the country, to allow people to do things, to give freedom to the people to choose what they want. The reason why we are not able to open an small and medium company in Cuba and to make a lot of money is not the embargo, it's the Cuban government. And now we are asking for that. So what can the U.S. Do in this moment? We need pressure.
Pressure.
on the Cuban government to stop with the repression and to give freedom and opportunities to the peoples. We need the international community like coming together to ask and to force the Cuban government to open up this country and to let people protest peacefully and to ask for what they want. And in the long term, the embargo has to change. And I would say U.S. government should stop with that policy. And most of people in Cuba, they support that. But I don't think U.S. government should open up the doors if they don't ask first the Cuban government to respect human rights. So mm-hmm. I think it's important and it's okay to have American people coming to Cuba, but not if they are going to government resorts to spend dollars in the government resorts. And at the same time, the Cuban government is using that money to repress the people. So my family sends me dollars from the U.S. Cuban government keeps the dollars, give me another currency, and then I have to buy those dollars in the black market, double price or wow. triple price, to buy food in the market because government sells me food in euros and USDs. So, you know, those are the kind of problems that we should avoid when we talk about, you know, stopping with the embargo.
So will you be going back into the streets tomorrow?
I don't know if I will go to protest tomorrow. I don't know if will be any protest going on. If so, of course, I'll be there. I think this is an historical thing when it's going on in Cuba. Maybe in a country like the U.S., you say, maybe people think, okay, that's normal. That's something that we see every weekend or every month. In Cuba, no. We had 60 years without having people going outside to the streets to ask for something. 60 years, not having that. You know, I was born in 93. So for the first time in my life, I see people from my generation who are not afraid or who don't want to be afraid and who want to go outside and try to get a better future for us. And that's what I will do. I don't want to leave Cuba in a boat, putting my life in risk. I don't want to go to Central America to cross borders to then go to the U.S. and also putting my life in risk. I don't want to be here in Cuba, sit down in my house, waiting to see if this government one day, after 60 years of doing nothing for our people, to see if one day they will solve the problems we have. So I don't want to wait. And if I have the chance to go again outside and to protest and to ask for what we want for this country, of course, I will go.
That is Jorge, one of the Cubans protesting in the protests in the Havana area.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Every Friday morning, our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us for All Over the Map, which is a look at the stories behind local places. And this week, the Green Book. If you saw the movie, you know what it is. It was the Bible of black travel during the Jim Crow era. And it wasn't just for the South. It was for the entire United States, including facilities right here in the Evergreen State. Here's Felix.
Yeah, morning, Dave. Yeah, the title of that book comes from its publisher, a postal worker who lived in Harlem named Victor Green. It was first published in 1936, and he issued it for about 30 years. Now, the full title, The Negro Motorist Green Book, is meant for black drivers on road trips. It started out just in the Northeast, but it grew to become a state-by-state guide with restaurants, hotels, nightclubs, you know, and places called tourist homes. These are just private homes that welcome travelers that served black customers at a time when other businesses might turn away black people or worse. Now, do you remember those comb-bound AAA triptychs from the pre-smartphone?
Yes.
Yeah, I love those. Those are fun to play with long after the trip was over. Now, this is what a testimonial says in the opening pages of the 1940 Green Book. We earnestly believe the Negro Motorist Green Book will mean as much, if not more, to us as the AAA book means to the white race. I mean, it really is a significant part of American culture, especially that travel culture that grows up in the 1930s, getting on the road and driving around. Now, the local group here doing research about it is called the Black Heritage Society of Washington. Stephanie Johnson Tolliver is president. She's a good friend of the show. We've spoken to her many times over the years. Now, she told me that black-friendly establishments in Washington, they first appeared in the 1939 edition of the book with just one hotel listed on Jackson Street, and that was the main street of Seattle's black community from the 1920s to the 70s, really. Now, in the later editions, businesses are mostly clustered around Jackson and around Madison on Capitol Hill. I'd been obsessed for years with an old house on the corner of Madison and 22nd, where I figured out 3 or 4 years ago that a place called Annie Smith's Restaurant, a Southern chicken restaurant, was located in the 1930s and 1940s. It's still there. You can see in old pictures and new pictures how it just, anyway, it's this amazing business, and it was listed in the Green Book. I learned, you know, a few years after I'd first found that it was an old restaurant. Now, the Black Heritage Society is doing all this research because an exhibit from the Smithsonian all about the Green Book is coming next March to the Washington State History Museum in Tacoma. Stephanie and the Black Heritage Society are partnering with the museum on some soon-to-be-determined local programs. And if you look at those pages, those Washington pages, you know, many of which are available as PDFs, and we've put a bunch at My Northwest, it calls to mind all kinds of questions. Like, you know, you wonder if the owners and operators of those Black-friendly businesses here knew they were listed. You know, did the Green Book actually generate enough traffic out here in Washington that the business owners would notice? And it's also unclear how much overt Jim Crow-style racism took place in Washington in those years. We're known here for being much more subtle, but still applying, you know, segregation and racism and keeping certain people of color out of different establishments. That's sort of harder to answer that question. But you have to admire the publisher for seeing a niche and then creating a practical workaround for an ugly reality. You know, it wasn't about to change anytime soon in the 30s or the 40s or even in the 50s and the 60s. A real practical way for people on the road to connect with safe and friendly businesses. And now, if you can't wait until March, Historic Seattle is presenting a virtual programming this coming Tuesday with the author named Candace E. Taylor. She wrote a book last year called Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. She's also involved in creating that exhibit that's coming next year. And Stephanie Johnson Tolliver is one of the moderators. You have to register online to get a Zoom link, but it's all free. We have lots of information at My Northwest, and we have those pictures of the Washington pages from the book. And I would love it if especially listeners in Tacoma and Everett could look at some of those addresses, type them into Google Maps, see what's there now. I mean, it's an incredible, interesting way to do digital geography to see what has changed over the years and where these businesses were clustered that were friendly to Black motorists 80 years ago. It's just a fascinating chapter of history that needs more exposure.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Have a good weekend, Felix.
You too, Dave. Thanks.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch is in for Colleen and Chris Sullivan. You very likely are going to get some free money appearing in your bank account because of the new child tax credit. Let's consult with our tax whisperer, Don DeSantis of Clifton Larson Allen. So let's just summarize the program because it's a little more complicated than it appears. Who gets this child tax credit, Don?
Well, Dave, actually quite a few people. It's estimated that as many as 35 million people could qualify, taxpayers, with up to 60 million kids in the United States. So it's quite a few people.
And there are income limits, but they sound to me to be remarkably generous. I mean, how high can you, how much can you earn before this tax credit disappears entirely?
Well, I won't answer that. I'll tell you where the phase outs start.
All right.
For single people, it's $75,000. For married filing joint, it's $150,000. So, you know, $150,000 of income is a fairly substantial amount, and that's where it starts phasing out.
Mm-hmm.
You get up to probably close to, say, $200,000, and it's gone. But even at that, this enhanced credit might phase out. You're still going to qualify for the old tax child tax credit, which for married people can go as high as $400,000 in income.
Wow. Okay, so under the enhanced tax credit, what is the maximum per child? And I believe it depends on the age of the child, too, right?
Sure. For kids 6 through 17, it's going to be $3,000 per child. And for kids under 6, it's going to be $3,600 per child. So, for example, let's say you had a family that made under those limits. And they had three kids. One was age 6, one was age 10, one was age 12. They would qualify for a credit for 2021 of $9,000.
That's real money.
That's real money, Dave. That example family will get $4,500 during the year. They'll get the other $4,500 when they file their taxes.
I see. So the checks you're getting now basically represent half the credit that you're owed.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Okay, what happens if you're, since this is income dependent, and since this is you're being paid in advance before you actually fill out the tax forms that would calculate the exact amount, could you have to pay some of this back if your income changes over the course of the year?
Yeah, and that's one of the really tricky parts here, Dave. This is not like those stimulus checks people got last year. You know, last year they were based on income. There were phase-out ranges. But the IRS had to guess, in many cases, looking at prior year returns, some people got those checks who shouldn't have qualified, and Congress said, fine, keep the money. This is a different program. No, you'll if you receive too much, you're going to have to pay it back.
So some people who are worried about having to pay a big tax bill at the end of the year, can they opt out?
Yeah, they can. And what the IRS has done is if you go to the IRS website, which is irs.gov, they have a child tax credit portal there. And first, it answers a lot of questions. So if you just have questions on how the program works, you can find that out at the IRS website. It's also going to tell you, apparently, whether you're enrolled, because the IRS is looking right now at 2020 returns. You can unenroll from the program if you choose, and you can change your banking info, because remember, they're sending you money, so they have to have your banking.
That's right. They have to have the routing number and everything.
There's one other thing at this IRS, at the IRS website that I haven't tried personally yet, but apparently there's a tax calculator, so you can enter in your facts, like this is how much money I think I'm going to earn in 2021. I have three kids. These are their ages. You can actually, you know, run a simulation to show how much you're going to qualify for and how much you're going to receive each month.
So if you feel you qualify, but you didn't see the check, then you can go to that website, too, and find out why.
Yes, apparently you can. This is so new. This is so new. Everybody's kind of learning because the first checks go out this month, July of 2021. And that is what is so different about this child tax credit versus the sort of, let's call it the historical child tax credit from prior years, is you don't wait till your return. They're going to send you money every month.
Yeah. And I believe the Biden people would like to make this permanent, correct?
Biden has proposed this at least through 2025, but he'd like to make it permanent because they feel that people at the lower end of the income spectrum, let's say, it was a little hard each year to wait till they filed their return and they'd get a credit once a year. Yeah. This is going to give them money throughout the year and it's going to help them with their, reduce child poverty.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if it turns out that because of this, you see fewer people having to go to food banks or take advantage of other federal programs, is it conceivable it could pay for itself?
Well, I'm not sure it could pay for itself. When this was put into the March tax bill that came out, the estimated cost is $100 billion.
Whoa. And that's all going to add to the deficit, isn't it?
Well, everything the government spends potentially is going to add to the deficit, Dave.
Don DeSantis, our tax whisperer from Clifton Larson Allen. Don, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
I've noticed this week that suddenly on the various talk shows, we're seeing all of the people featured in this series of new books on the Trump administration. And these are former Trump officials, right? And they seem to be saying, yeah, it was just as crazy in those last days as Trump's critics said it was. And yet many of them didn't say anything at the time. They did not resign. So we talked, as we usually do each week, to Face the Nation host John Dickerson, and in particular about General Mark Milley's claims about preparing for a coup attempt on the chance that Donald Trump might have started a war to stay in power.
This is a tricky thing that happens with all military planning, actually distinct from the idiosyncrasies of President Trump, is that they always look at a range of possibilities, and the range always has to go to its most furthest extreme because they always have to have options. So was that in his thinking? It would have been consistent with his planning as a military official to think about the worst possible outcome. Did he think it was the worst possible and unlikely outcome, or did he think that with a highly unpredictable president, that any outcome, as wild as it may seem, had to be considered because, and this was literally the way they used to do military planning under President Trump, because he would improvise and make up things on the fly and announce the withdrawal from Afghanistan without letting his generals know, they always had to think that even the most implausible possibilities were plausible because of his unpredictability.
Okay, so what do you think, as a longtime observer of the presidency, would, in a situation like that, when you have somebody who appears to be way out of control, is it your duty to resign, or is it your duty to hang in there and simply run interference as long as you can?
It's a fantastic question. I think, well, first thing, the duty is to think about and pick presidents and think about the presidency in a more serious way than we do.
Right.
And that's the first thing. But, you know, that's my boring hobby horse. In these instances, the idea of resignation, implicit in that idea, is that the public will see your resignation and say, oh, my gosh, the situation is dire. we must do something. Secondarily, that the person that you're working for, the president you're working for, will be affected by your resignation and public outrage over it, and therefore that will constrain their behavior. There's no evidence that the political system really works that way anymore, or that in this particular case, President Trump would have been constrained by anything. So the public benefit in a partisan world where there seems to be no fact that can change the minds of hardcore partisans, a resignation may not be that useful. But if you know how to work the system from the inside and you can appeal to those you're working with on the grounds of duty, honor, and country, which you could in the military context, which, you know, those binds still bind. A lot of the norms and boundaries have disappeared in the political world, but in the military world, they still exist. And so you could imagine somebody who had facility in that world appealing to those codes and norms and actually being able to do something. And in this case, he seems to have been able to do it. Not just with respect to this coup stuff, but also with respect to the president's response to the Black Lives Matter protests, wanting to have a much more military approach and Milley knocking that back.
On another issue, cybersecurity, you'll be talking about that this Sunday. In some of the White House briefings I've watched, Jen Psaki is very cryptic about what retaliation may have occurred as a result of Russia's attempts to interfere. Is it your assessment that we are taking a hard line on this and, you know, the lights have been turned off somewhere, or are we still afraid of what Russia's response might be?
Well, that's one of the things I want to ask Chris Krebs, who's on the show this week, former head of cybersecurity and infrastructure at the Department of Homeland Security. There are a couple of options. I mean, yes, was it U.S. counterstrikes that shut down the ransomware operation? Could it have been Russia finally listening to President Biden and taking care of these Russian-based hackers who operate in their territory? Or it could have been another country. So that's interesting because, as you say, who does the retaliating ends up being the one that might be the target for the next attack. And the concern has always been a kind of tit-for-tat escalation where the casualties are U.S. citizens. Because when you knock out a pipeline or knock out a hospital, the people who are affected are citizens, not necessarily military, the way you'd have in a conventional war. But I also want to talk to him about misinformation campaigns, including reports that were leaked this week about Russian efforts to influence the 2016 election, which he's very suspicious about, and also misinformation that the Surgeon General talked about with respect to COVID and the vaccines. And the misinformation being a barrier to getting the country vaccinated, which leads to, you know, deaths, given that everybody who's in hospitals and dying right now from COVID are people who are unvaccinated.
That's John Dickerson from Face the Nation. Dave Ross with Heather Boss, who's in for Colleen O'Brien. Local health officials are once again sounding the alarm on drug overdoses. And to give us an update on this, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Yes, good morning, Dave. And as we've heard earlier in the week, the national numbers for drug overdose deaths are just like those that have not been seen. And it's not a dissimilar situation here locally. We've had various meetings from State Opioid Task Force to the King County Board of Health yesterday, as well as others, trying to get an assessment of the situation and figure out what exactly to do about it. King County Public Health Interim Director Dennis Worshman told the County Board of Health that the top priority, the situation for King County.
The staggering number that 93,000 people have died in the U.S. this past year around an overdose death. Here in King County in this year, we've seen an uptick in particular around overdose deaths. And, you know, in a simple term of putting it, you know, about two people a day are dying in King County this year around overdose deaths. It's a public health crisis.
So that's this year. So we're talking the first half of 2021. The numbers are still very bad. He said this top priority for his department.
We really have embraced in public health a term called harm reduction. It's about meeting people where they're at. And in order to be able to offer change, I think you have to see the humanity in folks and where they're at in this disease process, and how we can provide services to them when they're ready, and how to keep them healthy and how to keep them alive. until we get to a place where they may want to make other decisions in their life around their own health. We want to make sure we're offering those opportunities for them, education, understanding, but most importantly, opportunities to remain healthy and alive.
Now, Brad Feingood is the strategic advisor for the drug overdose response for public health.
Some alarming trends, like the increase in overdose from 2019 to 2020, first half of 2021, a significant increase in fentanyl-related overdose. Fentanyl overdoses are skyrocketing, and so is methamphetamine-related overdoses.
So a lot of the same trends that I've been hearing for some time, but they're just continuing to get worse, and that's a huge concern. He said the big issue here is
one of the greatest drivers of drug overdose here in our county and nationwide continues to be the increase in fentanyl related deaths. Last year in 2020 alone, throughout the whole year, there was 172 fentanyl related deaths. In the first half of this year, we had 153 confirmed fentanyl deaths with a number of deaths still pending. So in the first half of this year, we experienced almost the same number of fentanyl-related overdose deaths.
Now, first of all, that's an astronomical number. That's one I had not heard before. So we've already surpassed all of the deaths that we had last year with fentanyl overdoses this year. Some of the things that they talked about in this meeting, and as well as others that I heard at the state level, were the ability to bring in some fentanyl test strips. So I think you and I may have talked about these ones before, Dave. The big problem with fentanyl is the synthetic fentanyl. It is the people who are buying what they think to be a Percocet. It looks like it's from the pharmacy. They're called M30s. Blue pills looks exactly like what you would get from the pharmacist, but it's not. It's what's made in someone's garage. It's all synthetic, and there is no quality control, if you will. So you never know how much fentanyl is in there. And that's responsible for the majority of the overdose deaths here and across the country. So the fentanyl strips allow you to, the drug user, to test your drug before you're going to use it, basically. So
And do they do that?
Yeah, those who have it, absolutely. I think I first heard about this. I was at the Needle Exchange in Snohomish County. This was maybe 2018, 2019. Uh-huh. And they had a pilot program where they were giving those out to people. And I just don't think there's been mass funding to get it out there and have it become kind of the norm like we see with needle exchanges. Because, you know, you're having people, it's one step further kind of, right? Because you're having them test their drugs. But the bottom line is it's about keeping them alive.
No, I understand the motivation, but what I'm wondering is whether when you've gotten to the point where you're medicating yourself with these drugs you've gotten off the street every mm-hmm. day, there's something else going on in your life. You've decided that there's just too much pain there. And I'm glad people will go to the trouble of actually testing what they know, what they must know is a dangerous pill before they take it. But to solve this, you got to intercept the problem before it gets to that stage, don't you?
Well, there has to be some prevention efforts as well. So that's something else that was in the King County Board of Health meeting specifically. There were some of the representatives from like Federal Way and South counties wanted to know, what are we doing on the prevention side? It sounded like there is something in the works that we should see, I believe they said, roll out here in the next several months, where kind of educating and getting into schools again and again giving access. So how do we teach kids about that, you know, don't, first of all, don't get into drugs in the first place. Mm-hmm. And then how do we teach the adults in the lives to recognize the signs of these kinds of drugs, right? It's not like marijuana and drugs from back in the day. It's different now. So how do we make sure that everybody's educated? So they're working on a countywide program, I believe, that should be rolled out sometime in the near future. The other thing that came up is safe consumption sites. These are, of course, as we know, the proposal we've heard off and on for several years now, recommended by the Opioid Task Force, I think back in 2016, where it's a place with a medical staff there that the drug user can come and use their drugs. And then if they, you know, overdose, there's somebody there with naloxone or whatever who can take care of them. But then also the idea is that you get them that offer of treatment as well. So eventually, maybe one of the times they take it. There was a lot of pushback, no place to cite that. Right. So now there was a $1.3 million, I believe, that came from the Seattle City Council that is going to actually come to fruition to do something soon. What they ended up shifting towards is existing places that kind of help people who are or chronic drug users and putting this system in place there. And there's already existing systems with like nonprofits.
I mean, isn't
like
that the reason for having low barrier shelters? I mean, that's what's going to happen in the hotels that they buy for people who are homeless. That will end up being a private place for people who are addicted to take their drugs.
Right. And look, it's the same as when we talk about having a team that goes out and tries to engage with people who are chronic homeless, right, or in the encampments all the time. It's about getting them in this tiny little window where they're willing to go ahead and get that treatment and make a change in their life for their own health, whatever the reason is. So you have to, when they say they want to meet them where they're at, they mean you got to just let them continue to use, make sure they're doing it in the safest way possible until they get to that point, because the main priority is to keep these people alive and help them turn their lives around. And again, as I said yesterday with our other story about mental health, there's still not that infrastructure for treatment on demand everywhere. So there's King County is better than most, but a lot of work still to do here and ongoing conversations.
Geiger Radio's Hannah Scott. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
Nearly 150 people needed lung transplants after the COVID-19 destroyed their ability to breathe. One father in that group knows every breath he takes is a gift thanks to a stranger. CBS's Carter Evans has your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft.
When COVID came for the Horbachevsky family, all five got it. But Bob got it the worst.
I was pretty close to being dead.
Rushed to the hospital, doctors put him on a ventilator. And only one thing could save his life.
We need to get him to St. Joe's Hospital to get him a lung transplant.
A double lung transplant. And while they prayed for a match, at home, his wife Monique tried to hold the family together.
My kids were hurting and they were struggling. Our life was falling apart. It's so easy to get like caught up in all of the fears of the what if and thinking that maybe I would have to live my life without him.
After 4 months in the hospital, they found a match.
Someone had to die for you to live.
Yeah, that's what saved my life, is somebody was willing to donate their lungs, and I'm able to breathe because of that right now.
Do you look at life differently now?
Oh, tremendously so. Every day counts so much more than it ever did before.
And every breath is a gift. Carter Evans, CBS News, Surprise, Arizona.
Wow, I can't even imagine, Dave.
Yep. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross, Heather Bosch is in for Colleen. Chris Sullivan is in for Chris. And Shannon Dreyer is in to talk about the Mariners from 710 ESPN. Now that we are halfway through the season, we have the Mariners in the middle of the pack in the AL West. They are above 500. They have been able, at least in some of their games, to control hitters like Shohei Ohtani, and they're facing the Angels now. I will say, from my perspective as a strictly casual baseball fan, my hopes are higher than they have been since 1995.
Well, that's saying something right there. I hope they don't let you down. It's been an interesting season. They went into the season believing that this was going to be their last year where they are really figuring out things with the young players, getting those young players experience, letting them get their legs under them, and then really evaluating to see what they need to go after as far as final pieces in the offseason. And I think that this group has surprised a little bit. And especially when you think about the losses that they've sustained, James Paxton didn't make it out of his first game. He was supposed to be a big part of this rotation. You lost Marco Gonzalez for a good amount of time. Both Kyle Lewis and Evan White, who are supposed to be just pillars of the core of this young team, are out, and it's sounding like Evan White is probably out for the remainder of the year. The hope is Kyle Lewis will be back in August. And so for those that remained and those that came up, to step up has been really spectacular to see. So to find themselves just 3.5 games out of a wild card spot at the break with nobody in front of them. It's the Oakland A's who hold that second wild card spot, and they've got a lot of games remaining with them. You know, at this point, you could say they control their destiny, which is, I don't think many people would have believed that if you had told them that back in February. So I think along those lines, it's been a successful season. I know the fans have really gotten into it. They fully opened last week, and it was just fantastic to see and hear so many more fans in the ballpark. But they are definitely in a position right now that they did not expect to be.
Is this something, Shannon, this next week to 10 days, you look, you've got the A's, the Astros, the Rangers, all division opponents, and you said obviously with the Angels, you know, you're looking at, is this the 2 weeks that will determine whether we go or don't or make it to the playoffs for the first time in, I don't know, forever?
I don't think so. I think it's an important week or 2 weeks, but if you look at what remains, there's 71 games remaining for the Mariners. 45 of them are against division opponents, so division games are going to be huge. It's going to be the bulk of what they do. So if they come out and if they have poor series against any of these teams, they still will have a number of games against them, especially later in the season. So they'll have an opportunity to make up there, but you certainly can go a long way in solidifying where you're at right now. And if you look at it, they have winning records against the Rangers and the Angels so far this season. They are tied in games played against each other with the A's. And the only team in the division that has a winning record against the Mariners right now is the Houston Astros, which right now is one of the best teams in baseball. So I think you hope to do your best that you can against the Astros. And if you can hold steady with what you've been doing earlier, you could be in a good spot.
Sounds like even you're a little bit surprised with how well they're doing, Shannon. So what is it that suddenly seemed to gel for this team?
Well, I think with a young team in particular, and I tried to tell people about this at the beginning of the season, ignore April. You might need to ignore May, too. It's not going to matter what happens in those months. It could matter as far as if you make the playoffs, but that was never the goal. This is an organization that is building to sustain, not just this year, but to continue going year after year after year. So the most important thing was that you evaluated the players that you had, either get confirmation on what you think they are or find out, okay, we need to go do something about this spot right here, and most importantly, grow them as a team. So I'm looking more at trends with them, particularly what they've done since the beginning of June. And so when you look at their numbers, no, they still have one of the worst offenses in baseball. Well, not since June 1. Sure, in April when you had all these young players and there were a lot of firsts and things to get out of the way, they were. So, you know, that surprises me a little bit. Now, on the same token, I will warn that in the second half, you know, this is still a very young team. And I think when you lost your Kyle Lewis and your Evan White, you had a Jake Fraley come up, and he was hitting out of his mind. Logan Gilbert has, I think, exceeded expectations early on, and that has helped as well. But when you have a young team, especially going up against more seasoned teams tend to start slower and really turn it on as the season goes on, and they know what to do in a stretch run. And the Mariners don't, you know, they haven't obviously been there in a long time, and they're still very young, and they don't really have players that have been there either. So I think that as they have opened eyes and made some surprises in this first half, now the road gets tougher for them because the baseball itself gets tougher.
Our Mariners insider, Shannon Dreyer. Shannon, thank you.
Oh, anytime.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.